Hey guys, welcome to episode 182 of the True Crime Couple podcast. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope all is well with you and you're ready for another episode. Before we begin, we want to thank you, first and foremost, for being our listeners and enjoying the show, hopefully. But we do have to do our normal podcast stuff at the beginning of this episode. So we beg of you, I'm just kidding, but actually seriously, if you could leave us a review, tell a friend about us, maybe post on your social media about us. Everything really helps, and we're really trying to keep this train going.
Yeah, going in the right direction.
Yes. So we would be eternally grateful if you could do all or one of those things. We would just really appreciate it because that's really the bread and butter of the podcast is the listeners. And we want to keep growing our listeners.
It's true. And, you know, when we look back from the start to now, we've done it all organically. And I think that that's something that Kay and I are very proud of. So the way that we've been able to do that is by you guys doing exactly that, sharing and following and doing all that great stuff, you know, which doesn't seem like a lot, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it is. So
thank you. It does really help. And we also love communicating with you and being able to interact with our listeners. That's always really fun, too. Okay. And also, we want to thank you if you've recently joined our Patreon page. And you could find that at patreon.com/truecrimecouple, or you could join on the Patreon app. There, you'll be able to get our episodes ad-free. And you'll get 2 full-length bonus episodes a month. So it's really worth the $5. At least we think.
At least we think.
Okay. So that's it. It's time to get back to our normally scheduled programming. John, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Of course.
Our case today brings us back to 1995 in Bellingham, a coastal town situated between the Bellingham Bay and Lake Whatcom in the northwest corner of the picturesque state of Washington. Bellingham has been broken up into various neighborhoods, 20 to be exact. Each is unique, but all offer the views that one has come to expect from the Pacific Northwest of the United States. The vibrant communities are all steeped in their own history. But today we will focus on the community that our victim called home, a place ironically called Happy Valley, which leads me to our story, where things are not always what they seem.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another. Are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
The Happy Valley community is located just south of Western Washington University, the country's oldest environmental college. The fact that Bellingham is home to a college has shaped the neighborhoods that surround it. The diversification of the community is evident there, as it is in most college towns. There are quiet neighborhoods that give way to the idea that Happy Valley is, at its core, a sleepy village. But there are also apartment buildings and restaurants that appeal more to the college style of living. Despite their differences, the under 6,000 residents of Happy Valley seem to live a, well, happy existence together. A symbiotic relationship, the ecology majors would like to say. And that brings us to Christy Onstad. When she was in middle school, Christy Onstad moved to a just under 1,000 square foot, 3-bedroom home at 3112 Wilson Ave in Happy Valley. She lived with her mother, Sue, and Sue's long-term boyfriend, who had been in her life since she was 5 years old, and his name was James Dickey, and her half-sister, Kayla, who was the biological daughter of her mother, and I guess we could call him like her stepfather because he'd been in her life for so long. Like it is for all kids, a move can be very difficult. But for 13-year-old Christy, it was made harder by how she was treated by the children of Happy Valley. It was 1994, and at Fairhaven Middle School, new bright and flashy fashion, or the grunge look, was in, but something that was only afforded by those who had the means to do so. And there is like a huge economic difference within Bellingham. I'm not too sure about now, but when I was reading about the case, there seemed to be a lot of economic disparity between people who had like really wealthy houses on the lake versus people who lived in maybe more of a lower economic standpoint. And Christy had not been one of those kids who had the means to dress in the newest fashions. With her large red Coke bottle glasses and a wardrobe that consisted of hand-me-down clothes from the 80s, she stuck out like a sore thumb. And the kids reminded her of it, because they can often be very cruel. She was often picked on for dressing differently. And, you know, that's the worst things that we could ever imagine, you know, being children in the mid-90s in middle school. You know, not only are you the new kid, but you're being made fun of because you're poor.
That's really sad.
Super sad. But Christy tried not to let it get to her. She wanted to fit in very badly, which makes things even more heartbreaking. She did this by being friendly to everyone and keeping a smile on her face. As time went on, she slowly began to come out of her shell. But still, she was known as being pretty quiet. But in looking for acceptance, Christy found herself in a bit of trouble. Although she had found an ally in one of her neighbors who would stick up for her on the bus if she was ever blatantly getting picked on, she had a harder time making real friends. And desperate to fit in and be accepted, Christy eventually found her place among, I guess, what you would consider a less desirable crowd.
Yeah, I mean, that might be because they're making her feel like she's the poor kid in school. And I mean, I would imagine that, you know, at some point you're going to gravitate towards people that are or have been deemed or classified as the same or less desired people. Right. I mean, it's so sad how school is. Right. When you think about it now as an adult, you're like, wow, that's actually kind of messed up, right. You know, but it does happen and it sucks. But I think when people make you feel not worthy or less than someone else, that you're not of, let's say, equal value, you know?
Yeah.
I think that you walk around thinking that no one cares about you. And I think it almost like it makes you a target, not just for like the abuse that you'll suffer in school, but also that might carry a longer kind of, you know, sentence, so to speak. Like, you know, you go through life then for after high school thinking that you don't matter, you know, and like, yeah. it's terrible, but it does start here, you know.
Yeah, it lowers your self-worth, and that means you're more willing to accept people that aren't treating you based on your worth.
It's true.
What we know of this friend group is kind of next to nothing, so we don't know if she was accepted by them because they understood what it was like to be outcasts or to be different, or because they saw her as an impressionable young girl that they could manipulate. Because this was kind of like the crowd that like skipped school, smoked, did things like that. So we don't know if they were like, you know what, maybe we'll protect her or, you know, we can have fun with her. We don't know necessarily why this group took her in, but they did.
Now, she, like you said, she was new, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's probably one of the reasons, too. I mean, you're in a situation where you literally don't know anybody.
And this is the first group to accept you, so you're going to jump to them.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So either way, we know that once Christy fell into this circle, she did take on some bad habits. And by that, I mean smoking, not caring as much in school, and having a bit of what was described as a rebellious streak. Once she started hanging out with this group of friends, she also developed a habit of running away, which made things all the more complicated when she truly did disappear. On April 15th, 1995, 14-year-old Christy had run away from home. Like she had in times before, she returned the very next day. But then the day after her return, on April 17th, she was missing again. As I said before, this had happened before, so it was something that Christy's mother, Sue, had grown accustomed to. But this event seemed different, so she had decided to call the Bellingham Police Department, who made a missing persons report. According to the report, Christy was reported as a runaway by her mother. And that's going to kind of start off this investigation a little bit slower because she's been reported as a runaway and she has a history of running away in the past.
Now, I hate that. I hate that so much. You guys have no idea because I understand that she has a past of doing this, right? But the focus in which they're going to investigate that, I feel like takes away from it. They're not going to take it as serious. Because she might turn up in a day or two, which is, in my opinion, unacceptable because she's, what, 13, 14 years old?
Yeah, she's 14.
I understand that that happens, but what if in the off chance that this is something that's actually taking place or she's been kidnapped or taken, whatever?
Well, that's something I think that they do take into account because the police, I have to say, really do listen to the story that Sue is telling them and her stepfather, James, because they're listening to how this is a little bit different. And in the past, when Christy has run away, they haven't necessarily called the police because they knew she ran away.
I see.
Versus this, where it's a little different. She does describe it as a runaway because this had happened just 2 days after her last runaway. So maybe she's thinking it's like she's still angry about or upset about something. So although it's reported that way, it does affect the beginning of the investigation, but only for a few days.
Okay.
So, according to the report, the last person who had seen Christy was her mother's boyfriend, James Dickey. And this is around 8:20 a.m. when he dropped her off at the middle school that she attended, Fairhaven Middle School. She never returned home after school that day. And when her parents called the school, they learned that Christy had not attended school. So she never went into the school. It is noted that she had run away before, but always returned. And her parents had said that she was in the middle of what they described as a rebellious streak. Now, I will say that there are like things in place now in the school system where something like this would not happen. And that's why it's so important when teachers take attendance, especially first period, middle school, high school level. It's different in the elementary school. But the second a student is not in school and their parent hasn't called them out, they called the parents. And if we can't get in touch with the parents, we send an officer to the home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's like the protocol nowadays, but I don't think that was what it was in 1995 because there also wasn't, you know, a large police presence in school because we are talking pre-Columbine.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah, that's there you crazy. Go. Little okay. school history there.
Yeah.
So it seemed that based on her history, the plan from the police department was, let's see if she comes home tonight, and then we'll revisit this and begin our investigation tomorrow if she doesn't. However, just to be safe, they did put her name into the missing persons database, and they did issue a be on the lookout for all of their on-duty officers, and they also contacted the county police. So anyone on duty was looking for someone of Christy's description.
I mean, that's pretty good at least.
Yeah. It's really the best we could expect in this case at that time. The following day, Christy's parents did not wake up to find that she had returned to their home. Instead, they woke up to their phone ringing. A man was on the line. His name was Willie Golightly. He said that while he had been walking down Samish Way, he found a backpack that he believed to belong to their daughter because it was a teenager's backpack and their home phone number had been found inside. At some point in the conversation, it was conveyed to Golightly that Christy had been reported missing the day before. James Dickey, Christy's stepfather, I guess we could call him, went directly to the residence of Golightly to see if, in fact, this was Christy's backpack. After seeing the items inside, he confirmed that those were his stepdaughter's things. Dickey asked to take the backpack home with him. And not thinking this was the right thing to do, Golightly refused to give the backpack to Dickey. And he said he would feel more comfortable giving the items directly to the police if Christy was missing.
I mean, that's actually smart. I mean, I understand. Even in 1995, I think we're starting to get into the beginning of, like, having more foresight because, like, you might, okay, this isn't the, you know, the biological father of the child, And, you know, maybe this is where we start to think like the worst of people, unfortunately, like maybe this person is responsible. Let me not take a chance and just give it to police. I think that's smart. I know it might ruffle feathers, but I think that if a girl is missing, you do everything that you can possibly do in order to get the best result, right?
Yeah, it takes a bit of gumption, I guess I would say, for someone to be like, you know what, I'm not giving this to you. I'm going to call the police. So it is good that he did that from an investigative standpoint. And I also think some of that can be attributed to normal everyday citizens having a little bit more information about police procedures from television shows.
Right.
Like, as much as it's like fantasy and not really like it is on the shows.
Or corny.
Yeah. But like, at least we know, like, okay, you know what? If I give this to him, that could be bad.
Right. He could get rid of it if he was responsible somehow.
Right. It gives people cause for pause.
But at the same time, you also kind of feel bad pointing somebody out like that and not being not willingly give them something when that's their stepfather, because I feel like step parents have gotten such a bad rap ever, you know, since the beginning of time of, you know,
since Snow White.
You know what I mean? So I feel like that is something that happens. You know, you're not trusting of the step parent right away. Oh, the step parent could be a potential suspect or cause for wrongdoing. I don't know. But maybe they didn't do anything wrong, you know?
Yeah. I just want to correct myself. I meant Cinderella, not Snow White. I know people will come for me. We'll get a one-star review. Yeah.
You didn't say the right princess.
I know. So, yes, I completely agree. And that is what happens. An officer arrives at Golightly's house, and the man shows the officer the backpack and all the items that had been found inside. The items that had been found inside included a bus pass, a blue sweater, a pair of blue jeans, and some makeup. He also took the officer to the exact location of where the backpack was found. While Golightly and the officer went to the site where the item was found, James Dickey did not go with them. Instead, he stayed back at the house to wait for their return. The officer spoke to Dickey about the discovery of the backpack, and he described Dickey in his report as being very distraught and very upset about his missing stepdaughter. Now, from an investigative standpoint, let's talk about the location in which the backpack was found. I'm going to give you kind of like an idea of where the house is, where the middle school is, and where the backpack was found, so we could talk about distance. Golightly found the bag on the side of a road on Samish Way in a ditch. This area is located under a mile from the family home, on the other side of Interstate 5. But what we know at this point is that Christy was dropped off at her middle school, which is located in the Fairhaven neighborhood of Bellingham, which is further to the west. So that means that the family home is in the middle of where the middle school is to the west and where the backpack was found to the east.
Okay. Pretty simple, straightforward.
Yep. Now, according to Google Maps, the drive from Christy's house to the middle school is 1.6 miles. That's about a 5-minute drive. And the backpack was found about a mile east of her home. Therefore, Christy's backpack was found just over 2.5 miles, or 4 kilometers away from where she had been dropped off, approximately. It would have been very difficult for her to have done that walk. Not impossible, but it would have been very long, and she would have had to cross over an interstate. So it's more likely that she was in a vehicle versus her leaving anywhere on foot. And that's what investigators are going to the conclusion they're going to come to once this backpack is found where it has been on Samish Way.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, I understand what you're saying. Like, yes, it could be done on foot, but the likelihood that it was, due to the fact that there was a way that you would have to cross an interstate.
A pretty kind of large interstate. Things. Yeah.
Yeah, like that changes things, especially for a 13-year-old or 14-year-old. Right. I keep messing up. What is it?
14.
Sorry, 14. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of difficult.
Yeah, it was April, so her birthday is October 2nd, the day before my birthday. So that's why I remember it. And she was just about to turn 15.
Gotcha.
So she was about 4 months shy from it. So now that Christy had not returned and her backpack had been found on the side of the road, the investigation was kicked up. The detective first spoke with the family, and he said that immediately, based on what he heard from them, the fact that she had not taken more things with her, the fact that her backpack had been found, he got an indication right away that this is more than just a missing persons case, and he truly believed that Christy was in trouble. So now this is the second day that she's missing, and the police are really taking her disappearance seriously, and it's no longer just being classified as a runaway.
Now, I wonder, now this is obviously, I know nothing, but I wonder now if they think that not just based on where the backpack was found and then also the contents in the backpack would then indicate foul play of some kind, right? Like, I wonder if they maybe they were thinking something more about the backpack.
Well, yeah, I think that the fact that she no longer has the backpack with her, and if she was truly running away and say those items are like clothing of hers, her mother did say that those were her favorite pair of jeans that were in the backpack. So if it was discarded, that meant that somebody discarded it or she had been grabbed and it was left behind.
Right, because she wouldn't have done that.
She wouldn't have just left it on the side of the road in a ditch.
Yeah, right. It's weird. But yeah, I mean, maybe it's foul play. I mean, she's obviously still not found. I mean, we don't know where she is right now, so.
Exactly. But before we get further into the investigation, what we're going to do now is take a break and talk about our sponsor of today's show.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
So the first thing that the detective did to get a better understanding of Christy and where her head was at leading up to her disappearance was to speak to the people at the school with whom Christy associated herself. The students all stated that they had not seen her the day of her disappearance and that they didn't know where she was or where she could be. However, the detective did get interesting information from one of the girls that Christy had been close with. She said that Christy had been close to telling her something that she knew was really upsetting her a lot, but that she never revealed to her what it was. She said that Christy was very emotional about it, whatever it was, and that she believed it had something to do with her house, but she didn't feel comfortable enough sharing it yet, so the girl gave her friend that space. In an article from the Bellingham Herald, printed on April 22, 1995, and a later court transcript, we learn what happened following the interviews that were had with Christy's friends. On the 20th of April, the Bellingham police planned to start a search for Christy Onstead. That same day, they received a phone call from someone who wanted to report a sighting of Christy in Bellingham's downtown area with a boy. This is a common place for the youth of the town and college students to be, so it seemed like a plausible place if Christy had in fact just run away. They were able to track down the boy that Christy had supposedly been seen with, but he claimed to not have seen her since before her disappearance, and his story and alibi completely checked out. Now that becomes, the sighting thing becomes an issue because what the sightings that were reported of Christy did was kind of reinforce the idea that she was a runaway versus that she disappeared.
Okay.
There was also a news report from local channels that discussed Christy's disappearance. On it, James Dickey looked into the camera and asked for Christy to just call them, to let them know that she's okay. He looked into the camera and said, "Just come home. Just come home." By the 21st of April, Christy had been missing for just about 5 days. Her mother was beside herself with grief, and her stepfather, because, I mean, it's really her mother's boyfriend, but we'll just say stepfather, was very vocal about the inaction of the Bellingham Police Department and the Whatcom County Sheriff's Department, who had been officially involved in the investigation since the day prior. Like, he's talking to the media and saying the police aren't doing anything. Like, where's the searches? Where's everything? Like, we know where the backpack was found. Why aren't they looking around that area?
You know, I commend, you know, the stepfather to like get involved and to say those things, but to create doubt within your community, which how many people are in this town? 6,000?
Well, 6,000 just in the neighborhood of Happy Valley, but it's a very large town, Bellingham. Okay,
and then at this point, you do have like more than just local police department. You have way more than that going on.
The sheriff's department's now involved.
So you probably shouldn't be doing that. I think that it's not in good taste to do that, because if all these people in the towns start to feel like, oh, wow, they're not doing anything, don't you think that causes some kind of like, I mean, it's like
distrust.
Yeah. Like, I don't think we should be there yet. I think that they're trying the best that they can.
Well, I think what they might be upset about here, it's still what they believe like is being treated as a runaway situation. Because at this point, 5 days into a 14-year-old girl going missing, we're usually seeing a lot of FBI involvement, and there's been no FBI involvement.
That's also true, because it's past 48 hours. I mean,
And it's a missing child.
Right. I mean, that is true.
So he believed that they were doing nothing to help his family. So he was the one who was going to have to step up. He did so by organizing his own search party with people that he knew and volunteers from the neighborhood. The police were made aware of this search party when many residents began to call the sheriff's department to report large groups of people trespassing on private property.
Okay.
Which could be a problem in the state of Washington. When they went to respond to these calls, they realized that James Dickey had organized this search, starting from the area from which Christie's backpack had been found. This situation basically forced their hand, though, and they now had to get involved with this search so it didn't go south. Like, either way, they really had to get involved once the search started, because if evidence was found and not handled properly, it would be disastrous for the investigation. And if a confrontation was had between a searcher and a homeowner, that would be bad, too. So the Whatcom County Search and Rescue Team was called in to aid in the search. Because the police were now involved in this search, the detectives who had been assigned to the case also arrived. The detective spoke with the deputies who had initially responded to the trespassing call and those who arrived after, and they all came to the same conclusion. They understood a parent wanting a child to be found, but what was happening seemed odd and not necessarily matching that intention. The deputies at the scene said that when they arrived, there was no door-to-door canvassing that was taking place, which is encouraged during ground searches when investigators are looking for a missing person. However, this was not what was happening. It was only a ground search, almost like James Dickey was having the neighbors search for a body, not necessarily a missing teenager. So if the police were to have done this search, they wouldn't have conducted it this way. But others feel like, well, you didn't even do that. So you can't really complain about the way this man's conducting it.
Right. I see what you're saying.
It's a double-edged sword. But the detective thought it was odd. The way that it was like being run as a, we're looking for a dead body kind of search.
That is odd. And I think it's time for a red flag, actually. Because I think that the stepfather's involvement, even though it is, you know, he's doing the best he can, and he's trying to advocate for his missing stepdaughter, which, I mean, that's wonderful. But I do find it a little odd, you know, that he would go to these lengths and inserting himself in such a way that it's making us be like, something smells rotten here.
Yeah.
You know? Also, another red flag, I feel like, well, I don't have a kid, and I'm not a girl, so I wouldn't know, or any other. I never ran away before. But I find that is something that we need to investigate, and hopefully that the investigators actually do that, because...
Oh, like the reason why she was running away.
Why she's running away, because I think that even though this is like a quote-unquote rebellious time, I think that there's more that goes into running away, whether it be fighting inside the house, whether maybe if is the stepfather fighting with her, is the mother fighting with her, what's happening to cause her to run away. It's more than always what meets the eye. It's like there's more there.
Right.
So I hope that that's something that we look into. So those two things, his involvement and what's really happening at home to make her run away in the first place.
Nope, those are good thought processes because those are the same thoughts that the detective had. And when he was talking to the sheriff's deputies and they were saying that they thought this search was a little bit off, it made him recall a comment that was made when he was giving that initial interview with the parents that struck him as odd. When Sue Onstad had been recounting the time that they initially found out that Christy had been missing because she never attended school that Monday, she said, "I even asked James if he got mad and did something to her." Now, at the time, the detective asked her why she would even ask that. And Sue replied by saying that she knew that James had a bad temper.
Okay. Okay, well, that's something.
That's something. It's very odd. You know, your daughter goes missing, and then the first thing you do is you ask your boyfriend, did you do something? Strange. At the time, he remembered thinking that's not a normal statement or question you should be asking of your partner. And if it was, and it was really asked, it meant that something was wrong in their house. However, at the time, during the initial interview, he didn't have any evidence or any other kind of indicator that something wrong was happening, and he didn't really even know too much about the case yet. He had just been assigned to it, so he didn't do anything in that moment or kind of press those questions. It also made him think back to that conversation he had with one of Christy's friends a few days prior. The girl had said that Christy was going to tell her something, but that she never did, but that it had something to do with her house.
Her house?
Like, meaning like in her home.
Ah, okay.
So, although, like, because the verbiage was odd, he didn't make that connection. And now he's like, oh my God, is this a bad home situation? That's why she was running away. The mother even asked the stepfather, did you do something? So, and now this guy's inserting himself in the investigation. What's going on here?
I mean, it's looking like he's a suspect. I mean, not to like lock him away right now, but I think it's worth investigating him and kind of delve a little deeper into his, like, what he was doing that day.
Right.
Or what, or the days leading up to her missing.
Right, because he was the last person to see her.
Yeah, that doesn't look too good.
No, it doesn't. Another thing the deputies who had been present at the search shared with him that they thought was odd was the organization of the search. They knew that James Dickey was not in law enforcement and had never organized a search before, but the concept seemed simple. You search the area surrounding where her backpack was found, right? Or any clue. Well, that was not how Dickey had instructed the people that had agreed to help him with the search. Instead, it seemed that he was directing them in a specific location by sending them to search only in one direction. Essentially, he was steering the search. So was it away from something?
I think so.
The detective wanted to talk to James Dickey, and he figured that sooner was better than later, because the man had been acting suspicious. He asked Dickey, who was at the command post, if he would take a drive with him down the road so the two of them could have a conversation in private. He agreed. Once they got to the location where the conversation would happen, the detective let Dickey know that he was not under arrest and that whenever he wanted, he could end the conversation. When a police officer starts the conversation that way, you know you're in trouble.
Yes, exactly.
The detective asked him if it was okay if he could record their conversation so he could better remember it later. And Dickey agreed.
See, and that's something that is very crucial to an investigator, to being able to record the conversations that you're having. Because in the moment, you're so involved with trying to get him to open up, feeling him out, reading the body language and doing all those things that you might, as a human being, forget details. But if you have it recorded, it's like having a second brain literally to go back to and just be like, hey, look, he said this at this time while I was asking him this. Like, this is perfect.
Right. You also get the inflection that the person's using, their tone of voice, if they pause when you ask a question. And these are all things that people forget over time.
Yeah.
So the recording of a conversation is phenomenal.
It's crucial, actually.
The detective asked Dickie about what had been going on at home before the disappearance, because only 2 days prior, Christy had run away from home. He said that with his stepdaughter, there had been more rebellion happening lately, and that during the last couple of weeks, things had gotten really bad. He said that he and Christy's mother were trying to defuse the situation within their home. The detective asked the man to describe the changes that he thought were going on in his stepdaughter's life to cause her to act this way. He replied, "Attitude, attitude, you know. It's like you ask her to do the dishes and she acts like you beat her, man. You abused her. Man, I have a tendency to yell a lot." He also admitted that he and Sue did not like the new crowd she was hanging out with. So after that, what he's going to do, you know, here comes the part where the detective tries to disarm Dickie. He tries to make him feel like he understands it's difficult to go through when it's not your child, and like to discipline them is complicated. And that kind of makes him open up a little bit more. And that's when the detective is going to ask him the question that he's been waiting to ask. He asked if he ever lost his temper with Christy or hit her. Dickie told him no, that he had not. And after the conversation turned to the last time that he had seen Christy, because remember, James Dickie was the last person to have seen her, this is where things start to get odd. The whole time, and in his statements and to the media, James Dickie had been telling investigators that he had dropped Christy off at Fairhaven Middle School. However, now he was saying that actually he dropped her off in front of the BP gas station near the school, because that was where she wanted him to let her off, because that's where a group of kids were waiting for the school day to begin. So this is new information and a huge deal, because you're going to run into different people at a BP gas station than you are at a middle school.
That's true.
And she could have gotten into a car with somebody, because that's what they were thinking. The distance between the middle school and where the backpack was dropped off had to have been traveled by vehicle.
I mean, it's definitely worth looking into, right? I mean,
but if he's so concerned about this investigation, why would he not say that?
I mean, that is something that is a crucial piece of evidence that should have been told the day that they called.
Yeah.
Like, hey, my daughter's missing. Let me give you every available detail. Now, listen.
This is where I dropped her off.
With that being said, though, I mean, we are only human, and sometimes we do have a tendency to forget certain details in the heat of having a lot of stress and a lot of, things going on. But still, you should have thought about that at least within those first 5 days.
Especially when you're so concerned about the police not doing their job.
Correct. And calling them out for it, like, publicly. So.
Right. So finally, the detective asked Dickie if he knew where Christy could be or could have gone to. He said he had no idea where she could be, but he didn't think she was still kicking.
What?
Yep.
Wait, that's exactly word for word verbatim?
Word for word.
Okay, this guy
I don't think
odd.
She's still kicking.
Yeah, this is an odd guy. Odd bird.
The detective asked him if that meant that he thought she was dead, and he said, yeah. He asked a follow-up question. Why would you say that? And Dickie answered, because she's got a big mouth.
Wait, hold on. This is your stepdaughter that you care so much about and call out police that they're not looking for her properly, yet you say those two phrases?
Yeah.
It's wild to me.
It's very interesting.
It kind of almost makes me think that this dude's responsible for it.
It's a lot of red flags.
That's a big red flag, actually.
Also, during the interview, the detective at one point took out Christy's backpack out of his trunk. Now, I'm going to ignore that, break in the evidence chain. I don't know why the backpack's in this detective's trunk. But what's more important was Dickie's reaction to it. So the detective said when he pulled the backpack out of his trunk that Dickie got extremely pale and shaky.
Interesting. Do you sense what I sense? It's like almost like an overconfidence that he thinks that he could use those phrases and like, I don't know, like even though he got a little nervous when that backpack was pulled out, I feel like if he is responsible at this point, I'm getting the sense that like he's looking at it like, well, they didn't find her body, so I have nothing to worry about.
Well, I also think the detective did a good job, because I heard some of the audio clips, like a really good job at disarming him and making him feel like, yeah, I know what it's like. Kids can be really difficult to handle.
Right. But
especially
I think
at this age.
Yeah. I think his overconfidence, though, is making it even more so that, like, okay, maybe you are a responsible dude. Yeah.
I think it's a wild statement to say that you don't think she's still kicking.
And that she has a big mouth.
Yeah. And that, but then you're also at the same time so concerned that you just started this search, which you're currently at right now.
And the phrase itself, I think, is very telling because
nonchalant.
Yeah. You have a big mouth. She has a big mouth. Okay. Well, that would imply that she has a secret to tell or something to say about you or your, or her mother.
Or
something.
What's happening at home.
Right. Yeah. So why would you say that?
Right. Like, what does she have a big mouth about?
To me, that's indicating motive, if anything.
Well, I think it also implies the fact that they have a lot of fights because now he could mean big mouth in that way or the fact that she fights a lot.
Right.
But she's also a 14-year-old girl. So it seems like he's treating her almost like she's not 14 years old. And
correct.
He doesn't care. That's callous to say, I don't think she's kicking. That's the callous thing to say.
It is, especially when you have your wife at home worried about her child.
Right.
So I don't know. This is all rubbing me the wrong way. It really is.
So as you can imagine, the detective was highly disturbed by this interview, as we are. When they got back to the command post, the detective asked Dickie if they would be able to search his van because it was the last place that Christy was seen. And maybe she had dropped something inside, like a note. To his surprise, Dickie agreed to the search and signed the consent form. Using a flashlight, the detective looked over the van, but didn't find anything inside that was Christie's or evidence that there had been any kind of a struggle. Because the detective would later reflect that he believed, especially in that moment, that if Dickie did murder his stepdaughter, that most likely it had taken place in that van, a van without windows. So that's what he'd been looking for that day in the search. But there had been nothing.
Nothing at all? No evidence?
No evidence in the van.
Hmm.
And he's a mechanic. I mean, what he did have there was some tools, but that was it.
Tools in like a toolbox?
Yeah, in a toolbox.
Okay.
Having no other evidence, nothing further could be done with James Dickie. But his behavior was noted for the detective, who would be sure to keep watching him. And he worried that soon he would be investigating a homicide and not a missing persons case. As to what kind of investigation he was going to have to do, the detective would receive his answer only hours later. At 8:30 p.m. on the night of April 21st, he received a phone call from the search and rescue team that had stayed to finish the search of the area. They had discovered a female body near the south end of Samish Lake, off a dirt road near Null Road, the direction opposite of where James Dickie had been guiding the search.
Oh, my God.
That's why the search and rescue team was searching that area later, because James Dickie had been directing the search towards town, and they found this body 8.5 miles in the opposite direction.
So it seems like he was leading them from, you know, the opposite direction for a reason, because he was probably responsible here.
Yeah.
I think that's what we're dealing with, honestly. I mean, why else would you do that?
Yeah. I mean, in reality, one way or the other, it's better that the search and rescue team found this crime scene, because then that means it was able to be preserved correctly.
Yeah.
The two detectives that were working on the case went to the scene, and they were able to determine that it was the body of 14-year-old Christy Onstad. This is going to be an extremely difficult discovery of the body to hear, so I just want to warn you before I begin. The detective said he will never forget the scene as long as he lives, and that from time to time, it still plays out in his mind. It was impossible to tell how Christy had died because so many horrible things had happened to her. The upper half of her body was covered by a plastic tarp. She had a shirt on, but it was half pulled off and over one of her shoulders. She was naked from the waist down, except for a pair of socks. A plastic bag had been placed over her head. When the detectives removed the bag, they found a black belt still wrapped around her neck. It had been used to try and strangle her. There was a metal spike sticking out of one of her ears, which was embedded deep into her head. She had been bludgeoned in the head with some type of blunt object. It was also apparent that she had been raped. Two red flecks of paint were recovered from her body. This is when the detective that had spoken with Dickie earlier that evening said that based on what he had learned from Dickie in that interview, that he really thought he was involved. And now the fact that the murder was evident and Dickie had made the statements he did, he was nervous that this had scared Dickie. Meaning like, he might have slipped up saying that to detectives, so now he might know that they were onto him and that might make him paranoid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because of this, the detective thought that maybe, in an attempt to further cover up his crime, Dickie might return to the body of his stepdaughter that night.
Don't tell me they canvassed it and they waited for him to come.
Well, what the detective, this was the detective's thought process.
Okay.
It's 8:30 p.m. By the time they got there, it was 9. There was no way they were going to do a good crime scene sweep in the middle of the night. So they might as well see if they could maybe catch James Dickie coming back to the scene. So he told the search and rescue team, pick up everything that's yours from the scene. Let's clean it out to make it look like this hasn't been discovered yet. And we'll have someone posted here, like kind of hiding, to see if he shows up.
Brilliant.
So that's what they were going to do. And then if he doesn't show up that night, they were going to bring the crime scene teams out early the next morning, which they were going to do anyway.
Okay.
Well, Dickie never came back to the area.
Damn.
So the following morning, the crime scene analysts were called in and a more thorough search of the area surrounding the location of Christie's body was completed. It was that morning that Christie's mother was informed about the discovery of her daughter's body. They would have notified her that night, but she's living with their number one suspect.
And that makes things really tricky, as you can imagine.
Right. And that's why they waited to let her know, because they didn't know if this was going to tip him off in some way.
Right. Or like he might try to run away or leave if he is responsible.
Correct. So when they broke the news to Sue about the discovery of Christie's body, and I can't imagine as a mother hearing that that's how your daughter died, they also asked her where James Dickie was, and she said that he had gone out to run errands but that he'll be back shortly. This worried them. They waited for James Dickie to return from running errands for hours. They kept calling Sue back. He wasn't there. So finally they believe that he's now on the run.
So he actually did. Okay.
That wow. He got nervous about what had happened the night before. He thought the police were onto him. So, and he probably was thinking it's only a matter of time before the body's found. So a be on the lookout was issued for both James Dickie and his van because it was missing. While the search was underway for James Dickie, the detectives decided to question some of the neighbors to see if they had seen anything. And one of them, the boy who had developed a soft spot for Christie and would sometimes defend her on the bus, said he did notice something odd. After Christie's disappearance, he had seen James Dickie hosing down the inside and outside of his van.
Okay.
And this is something that struck him as odd because in all the time the family had lived there, he never saw Dickie cleaning out his van, and it would have been something that he noticed because he said, like, all the neighborhood kids called it, like, the molester van.
What if one day people think that about my van outside?
Well, it's a work van. It's like, well, they might.
No!
Oh, my God, that's your dad's creepy van.
No!
Oh, that's going to be you.
Ah, man.
That's okay.
It's like, I need that van. I need to go to work.
It's required for my employment.
It's required.
So the community of Bellingham was shocked to find out the fate of 14-year-old Christie Onstad. And I hope that those children did some reflecting and changed after that, by the way.
Yeah, I agree.
Because we'll get into it later. But they were even more shocked to find out that law enforcement's number one suspect was James Dickie and that he was on the run. How could this man have done something so brutal to the girl that he had known since she was 5 years old? There was another layer to this that law enforcement had never had to deal with before. They wanted to be there for Sue. Her daughter had been brutally murdered, and murdered in the worst way they had ever seen and will ever see for the rest of their careers. They wanted to comfort her and reassure her, but they also wanted to be really careful because they didn't know, you know, was James Dickey going to reach out to her? What did she know about these crimes that took place? It was like really weird, blurred lines at this stage in the investigation. And they just had to be cautious during this time. They're going to later learn that Sue had no idea, and she was just as blindsided by this as the community was. The detectives went to her home after speaking with neighbors and told her that they would like to search the house, that they believed that James had done this, and he had left. She seemed to understand that he had not just gone out to run errands anymore, that something really bad had happened under her roof. She gave them permission to search her home. During the search, law enforcement found a box container that had several different state identifications in it.
Okay, that's weird.
What was odd about them was that they all had different names and ages on them, but they all had James Dickey's picture.
Don't tell me that this is not his name.
So who was this man?
Don't tell me.
And now how are they going to be able to find him if he was hiding under a different alias, potentially? And more had been found when James's van was found abandoned at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. In his van were more IDs. They had three different names, all different ages, but all the same picture.
What are we dealing with here?
This ever-evolving case was going to do so one more time. When the police were contacted by someone 24 hours into their search for their number one suspect, James Dickey, he told them that he knew who they were looking for, but that James Dickey was not his name. His true identity was Clark Elmore. He was asked how he knew this for sure, and the man replied, "Because he's my twin brother."
Get out of here.
Yes.
We have an evil twin who likes to be an international spy wannabe.
Child murderer.
Child murderer.
Yeah.
On the loose. With yes. A twin that hasn't done anything wrong.
Yes.
Oh, man.
It's wild case.
So is this guy like some kind of grifter?
Or
is
well, like I some wouldn't weird say guy? So because, I mean, he has been in this relationship with Sue Onstead for 9 years. However, they have moved around a lot.
Okay.
Like he originally met Sue, I believe it was in North Dakota. They moved around several times before. Now, think about it. They've only been here for not even a year.
Okay. I'm just going to say something. What if the reason for the moving is because he was doing things to like in the places they were living and then finally settled down here for the last 9 years? Or, you know.
I'm also going to say this because we've seen it happen in other cases as well, and it's very unfortunate that sometimes if there are cases of child abuse that are maybe taking place, and, you know, it's known in the family that there are moves that happen quite often before the school districts can kind of pick up on it.
That's so sad. You wish that it would be able to be done sooner.
Yeah.
To avoid these kind of things, but I understand that's incredibly right. Difficult.
And, you know, the question, this is very complicated because, like we always say, you know, we're here for the victims and their families. But at the end of the day, it's really the victims that are the main priority of the podcast and the story that we're telling because it's their voices. But to some degree, her mother had to have known that she was not being treated right by her stepfather, I guess we can call him. It was still only her boyfriend. But because when she went missing, the first thing she asked was, "James, did you do something?" So you have like, why to
ask
know.
That? Yeah, right. Like, why ask that unless you had some kind of feeling deep down that like he could be
capable
of that? Yes,
or had at least hit her on another occasion?
Yes, or yeah, was physically violent, or did she walk into a very odd situation if she was being like molested or something? Like I'm just going to the most deepest, darkest parts of my brain with
all
this,
of
but
this. We don't know.
I know, and it's all hearsay. I know. I'm just saying, like, for her to have that reaction or and to say that to him, okay, means that she either walked in on something or saw something,
or whether it was witnessed her, or had witnessed him hit her, or right, be something. Very verbally, mentally, or physically abusive to her. There's no other reason why that would be the question asked. If I went missing, my mother would have never asked my father, did you do something?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So, okay. But let's go back to the twins.
Yes, please. This is wild.
Okay. So I am going to tell you about the upbringing and life of Mark and Clark Elmore. Their names rhyme. Yes. All of this information was compiled from an interview that was done with Mark Elmore. He said that they had grown up in Springfield, Oregon, that they were two of five children in a small house on L Street. They did not have a lot of money, and he remembered that all seven of them would sleep huddled together on three mattresses that had been pushed together in one corner of the room. They had no bathroom, and they were kept warm with only a wood stove. He reflected that he wasn't bothered by how they grew up. There was always food, and they were well taken care of. Although Mark and Clark were twins, people never thought that they were because of how different they looked, because they were fraternal twins. He said that he had always been bigger and that his brother Clark was smaller and had a stutter. Now, Clark Elmore is James Dickey. And there is very often a correlation that we see with stutterers and those who are later found as perpetrators. For both of these reasons, people would tease Clark for being small and for having a stutter, which would make him angry and would make him mouth off. Interesting, right? Because very that's what he says later about Christy.
Yes.
And when this would happen, he would get into a lot of fights where people would want to fight him. So like they'd be waiting for him after school. And Mark said that, you know, he always protected his brother and prevented those fights from happening and, you know, stopping his brother from getting beat up. But that this didn't bother him at all because he loved his brother so much. He explained that growing up, they were inseparable. And he said the connection between twins was very real for them. They could sometimes feel what each other were feeling. They could know what the other was thinking. After high school, the two parted ways. Clark went all over the place, from job to job, and developed a bit of a drinking habit. Mark said that he couldn't remember exactly what had happened, but he remembered that his brother was very unhappy, and that at one point he was sentenced to prison for 3 to 5 years, but he couldn't remember what for. I found out.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it was for forgery and then later burglary.
Okay, well, that makes sense because he's kind of making these fake IDs too.
Yes.
And, you know, so that makes sense, I guess.
When Clark came out of prison, he married a woman from California. However, this was not something that made him happy either. And in 1975, when she was 3 months pregnant, he walked out on her. This was something that Mark felt was unforgivable. So he stepped in and helped take care of his brother's wife all throughout her pregnancy, making sure the bills were paid, buying groceries. And he was there, as well as other family members, when his brother's daughter was born. Mark always stayed around and helped this woman with whatever she needed. And after she officially divorced Clark when their daughter was 8 months old, I know this is wild, Mark began dating her.
Okay.
So he's dating his brother's ex-wife that his brother walked out on. He said that he never had an in-depth conversation with his brother about this, but he did say to him once on a phone call, like, that's my daughter. And as far as she's concerned, you're just her uncle. Because he goes on to marry this woman and have children with her, too.
Whoa.
I know, it's wild.
That is actually insane.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, let's keep going.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
So we don't have Clark's feelings on this. On the surface, he seemed not to care because he didn't want the responsibility of this daughter. But, like, we're unsure of what his feelings about this situation were deep down. But it's a complicated dynamic because it is not right to walk out on your wife and your child. That's never something that's commendable. But you did that. You made that choice. But now, even though you made that choice, your family's like, nope, can't do it. And like, I'm going to marry her now.
It's like, yeah, that's terrible. But then it's overshadowed by something even worse.
So then your twin brother marries her.
That's weird.
It's a wild situation.
What's going on, man?
But I mean, it is nice that this girl is being raised by someone who cares about her and loves her. So like, despite whoever it is, I mean, you'd want her to grow up in a healthy environment. Hopefully she's told the kind of truth about the situation, because to find out that your uncle's really your father later on in life would be complicated, I would feel.
I think even though you'd be trying to do some justice there, I feel like all you're doing is making it more convoluted.
Yeah. Well, weird. Mark is going to say, like, the way he explains it is a little bit more like chivalrous, and it seems to like have made sense because it happened over time. It wasn't just something that like immediately took place, but like it had been over like 2 years and then they started dating. But anyway, yeah. Mark said that his brother had done something wrong and he loved making it right was his and he said he truly loved his wife, and listen, they stayed together.
Yeah, that's true.
So
yeah,
for years the brothers didn't talk, obviously, until they reconnected later on, closer to when the crime took place. And Clark asked if they could get together. He visited his brother at his home with his ex-wife and like his child, and he brought Christy along with him. Mark said that for the first time, he thought that Clark seemed happy. He seemed like he had done a complete 180 and that everything was going right in his life. And he thought that maybe his brother was making amends for what he did by walking out on his own family, by doing that with Sue and helping her raise Christy.
Okay.
So that's like kind of what he was thinking, like righting a wrong in his own life by doing it for someone else. However, there were a few odd things that happened that day, the first time they kind of reconnected. First was Clark told him that he changed his name. The first thing he said was, I'm going by James Lee Dickey now. So if that's what Christy calls me, she's going to call me James. And if anyone calls me that, that's just like what I'm going by now. And Mark thought it was odd, but figured his brother just maybe wanted a fresh new start, especially because he had a record, you know?
Okay.
During that visit, Christy had befriended Mark's daughter. Well, kind of Clark's daughter too, but you know what I mean. And the two girls went to play downstairs in the basement. Mark remembered thinking it was odd that his brother was constantly checking on the girls. It was like he didn't want to leave Christy alone. And he told his brother, like, stop bugging them. The kids don't want the adults down there. They're just playing. And Mark and his wife thought maybe Clark was just a really strict parent. They didn't know because they just hadn't seen him in like a decade.
Right.
So they didn't, and you don't know what someone's going to be like as a parent. It could be very different than how they are as a person.
That's true.
But it was about a year later when, out of the blue, Mark received a phone call from his mother that all of those things connected in his mind. His mother told him that Christy was missing and the family was distraught over it. But Mark just got this feeling, and it clicked, that all the times his brother had visited, he wasn't just going downstairs to make sure Christy was behaving or making sure that, you know, the girls were okay. He was making sure that Christy wasn't saying anything down there.
Saying anything? Right.
Like telling the girl.
Huh.
And that's probably why Christy didn't have a lot of friends, and they moved from place to place so often. She couldn't connect with someone. Like, see how she wasn't ready to tell her friend yet what was happening at home?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like he'd conditioned her to be scared about this. And he knew immediately that something bad happened to Christy and that he knew his brother was responsible for it.
It was very interesting that he would like see that and automatically like be like, hey, you know what? I think he's done something.
Well, I think like he was kind of saying that like in this like capacity to know your twin in a deeper way. And you want to think the best of them. And that's kind of what he did his whole life, was want to think the best of his brother. And then when he heard Christy was missing, it just like he came to this realization of like, I have to stop living in denial that my brother's a bad person.
Very interesting.
And his guilt is what made him call the police and say, Like, I know who you're looking for. His name is Clark Elmore. I believe my brother did this. And, you know, he was very distraught over the whole thing. It's emotional.
It really is.
And it's almost like, I know it's an odd situation when I first tell you, but it's almost like Mark has spent his whole life cleaning up his brother's messes.
Yes.
Making sure he didn't get beat up at school, taking care of the family that he left behind. And now this.
Yeah, I'm at every stage in his life, it looks like he's been picking up the pieces.
Yeah.
I know the whole thing with like the twin stuff. I know some people think that there's like an interesting connection that's exclusive to twins. And maybe here, that's kind of what's going on here.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah, I do too. There's something going on there.
But police would not have to go on a massive manhunt to find James Dickey or Clark Elmore because he came to them.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for making it easier for us.
Yes. On Sunday, April 23rd, 1995, at about 9 p.m., Elmore, because now we'll use his real name, went to the Bellingham police station and called 911. I don't know why he didn't just go inside, but the transcript of the call reads, "I'm standing out here in front of the Bellingham Police Department. Send someone over to lock me up." The woman dispatcher asked, "What's the problem?" "Murder," he replied. She asked who he killed, and he replied, "Christy Onstad." "What's your name?" "James Dickey. I want to turn myself in for killing my daughter."
Wow.
Once he was in the station, he agreed to waive his rights and said that he wanted to confess to the murder of Christy. He said that he had killed her in his van at a location near Lake Sammish. They wanted to wait for the detectives that were working the case to arrive, especially for a more lengthy and formal interview to take place, because this was going to be a very large investigation, even if it was a confession. And they didn't want this being messed up. So they wanted the detectives who knew the ins and outs of the case to be the one who questioned him so they could get all the information out of him while he was ready to talk. So once those detectives got there, Elmore again waived his rights and agreed to a taped interview. He told the detectives what really happened on April 17th. So again, this is going to be really difficult to hear. He said that he dropped Kayla off. Now, Kayla is the daughter that he shares with Sue at daycare, and then returned home at 8:20 a.m. When he got home, he found Christy to be there. He said she was complaining about going to school and stated that she had missed her bus. He said something along the lines of, "You're going to be grounded forever." And then she made a comment to him about how he had been molesting her. This is when the detective cut in and asked him questions about that. Elmore admitted that he had molested her when she was 5 years old. He claimed it was only one time, and that after that, whenever he tried to discipline Christy, she would always bring it up, like she was blackmailing him. I think that we can understand, based on many things, and I don't want to go too in detail about this, but based on the fact that she was, her behavior in school, the fact that she was withdrawn, the fact that they moved so many times, the fact that during this attack he did rape her, that this is happening a lot more than just one time at 5 years old, and that he had been molesting her since the time he met Sue. So that means that for 9 years, she endured torture from this man.
Yeah. And would explain him always having to like be around her so that way she can't share anything. It would explain like why she would run away.
Yes. And what I find interesting is that there's a correlation between her new group of friends and her runaways, because I think they were giving her a confidence that she had never had before. And as she's getting older, she's realizing, like, I can run away. Look, they do this. Or, you know, maybe they're kind of like tougher kids. And I think it was giving her the confidence to stand up for herself, which is why this happened.
Mm-hmm.
because she was standing up for herself for her first time, and he wasn't wanting to put up with that. And he wasn't expecting that from her because she had been his victim for 9 years, and now she didn't want to be a victim anymore, and he didn't know how to handle that. And that's what took place. So I think that's the correlation between the running away is her slowly beginning to gain her confidence because maybe she was finally finding a place.
I agree. I agree with that. I do.
Which is so sad.
It is.
So Elmore said that he wanted to kill her every time she made that threat against him. He also commented that he wished she would have just followed through with it because eventually it cost her her life.
Unbelievable.
Elmore said that when she brought it up again on the 17th, he told her to shut up and that he would drive her to school. He said that they were driving towards the school, but along the way he snapped. Instead of taking her to school, he just kept driving. After about 20 minutes of driving, he reached the area of Lake Sammish. He said he pulled the van off to a secluded dirt road, and then he unbuckled Christy's seatbelt. This is like going to be really difficult. So if this is something you don't want to hear, then I would fast forward about 3 minutes. After he unbuckled her seatbelt, he told her that it was time that she learned to do as she was told or she'd get seriously hurt. He then grabbed her by the shirt and pulled her into the back of the van. He told her to take off her clothes or she was going to get hurt. She refused, so he forcibly removed them. He said that she cried and pleaded with him, but he raped her. He said that she knew she wasn't strong enough to fight me, so she didn't. Now, Christy was 105 pounds. So she was relatively tall for her age. She was 5'6", but she was very slim. And I think that this is a telling statement that he made because it means he said she knew she was not strong enough to fight me. Meaning that this had happened before when she was at a similar size, right?
Correct. I mean, that's what I would gather from that, yeah.
The rest comes directly from the court transcripts. After raping Christy, Elmore placed his hands around her neck and manually choked her. He then wrapped his belt around her neck and cinched it tightly. Afterward, to ensure that she was dead, he took a 9-inch metal needle-like tool from his toolbox and forced it into Christy's left ear, approximately 5.5 inches in, piercing Christy's brain.
Oh my God.
Elmore thought Christy was still making noises, so he covered her head with a plastic bag to stop blood from getting all over the van and repeatedly bludgeoned her skull with a sledgehammer until he was sure she was dead. Elmore then dragged Christy's nude body into the woods, covered her with a plastic drop cloth, and got back into his van and drove away. On the way back to town, Elmore threw Christy's shoes, underwear, and school papers out the window. He then stopped for gas and continued on with his day.
That's disgusting. That is so disgusting.
Yeah. And I think what he's asking them to believe is ridiculous, meaning that this had only happened twice in the whole time that he had been in Christy's life. And I just don't think that that's true. And every piece of evidence and other statements he's made has spoken against that. I think this man is a complete monster and that she was standing up for herself and he wasn't ready to have whatever he was doing end. I think he planned on doing that for the rest of her life.
Or as long as he could have, yeah.
He said that the next day he went out and tossed her backpack into the ditch on Sammish Way, and that on Wednesday he cleaned out his van. He said that he had been contacting the media and talking about what a bad job the police were doing in the search for Christy to draw the heat off himself and to help cover his tracks. He said that once he knew the police were onto him, he fled. Now, remember, he fled the morning after Christy's body was discovered, but he also didn't know that her body was discovered at that point. And he told Sue that he was just going to go out running errands. He first drove to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. From there, he caught a bus to Eugene, Oregon, where he obtained new identification. Remember, he's going to Oregon because that's where he grew up. And he got this new identification using his twin brother's name.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, he was going to live under his brother's name somewhere else.
Unbelievable. See, so he doesn't even care about his brother.
He doesn't care about anybody but himself.
It's true.
And something made him abandon this plan. I think he just knew that he wasn't going to be able to keep everything up.
Yeah, I mean, he's literally living under a different alias, and he's been doing that. At some point, you know you're going to get caught.
Right. So he drove back, and he made his confession. The detectives and the prosecutors did not believe this was a one-time situation. And in reflecting on the hell and torment that poor girl had to live with her entire life, and the horrific way in which she had to die because she was trying to stand up for herself, they decided to charge him with the death penalty. Although Elmore had confessed, because they were seeking the death penalty, he was entitled to a trial to determine if there had been mitigating factors, which would then essentially take the death penalty option off the table. And although this was going to be hard to get through, Sue Onstead supported the trial because she thought that death would be too good for Clark Elmore for what he had done to her daughter. She told the Bellingham Herald that the family just wanted it to be done and over with. "It's going to cause more pain and suffering for us. We've had enough." Christie's biological father also supported the death penalty and the trial happening. They just wanted it to be speedy. During the trial, in which, and this is something that like wasn't found until they were doing the investigation for the trial to take place, because they were trying to look for witnesses that were going to corroborate the confession that he gave. Well, they found an eighth grade boy. Imagine you're you have to testify in this trial. So during the trial, an eighth grade boy testified that he saw Christie in a van fighting with a man that he identified as Clark Elmore. And in that trial, there were found to be no mitigating factors. Really, what his defense was trying to claim was that he had brain damage of some kind. So what's interesting is that they were claiming that where he grew up in Oregon, all the toxins in the ground, toxins that he was introduced to throughout his whole life living in the Pacific Northwest. He also went to Vietnam, where he had to do significant work with Agent Orange, that there was a point he'd been living somewhere and he'd been beaten up really bad. So he got a concussion. Then he got into a car accident where he got a concussion so badly that he was having post-traumatic seizures. And they were trying to argue that those were the mitigating factors that made him have frontal lobe damage, which led him to his impulse control.
Well, all I could say to that is obviously there always needs to be a defense, but that is ridiculous. But we all know that. I mean, listen, I've had 6 concussions in my life playing sports. I'm not going to go out there and maybe that explains everything. But I'm not going to go out there and do the most disgusting, most diabolical things of all time to somebody. So unless he was seeking medical treatment for those things, and even if he was, it still doesn't give a reason to do this. There's no excuse.
Right. Well, and that's why no mitigating factors were found.
Good.
And the death penalty was upheld. On March 12th, 1996, Clark Elmore was sentenced to death for the rape and murder of his 14-year-old stepdaughter. But in 2018, there was a ruling even before that. So, I mean, think about that. That was a long time ago. But the governors of Washington were kind of postponing the executions that were taking place. But then in 2018, there was a ruling in the Washington State Supreme Court that found that the state's current death penalty statute violated the Constitution of Washington on the grounds that it resulted in racial bias. Now, the 8 inmates at the time who were on death row, Clark Elmore included, had their sentences converted from the death penalty to life in prison. Now, this has led to frustrations within the Clark Elmore case, because he lost all of his appeals. Certain Supreme Courts did not even want to hear his case. They threw it out before. And when they did throw it out, there were two judges that wrote 15-page scathing opposition opinions to him getting an appeal. Like, they were like, this man is horrific and we're not even going to hear his case. And a lot of people argue that the reason why the death penalty had been thrown out in the state of Washington based on racial bias doesn't necessarily apply to Clark Elmore because he's white.
Right, right.
But nonetheless, it's a law. It's the way it is. And then it was even further backed up by the signing of a law in 2023 by the governor of the state of Washington. No matter what you believe about the death penalty, I think it's just that Clark Elmore's a monster. And I guess what people in the state of Washington, the reason why they advocate for it is because they just think that when you think about the worst things you could do to someone and to a child who you're supposed to be protecting, it's like you should get the ultimate punishment. I just think that's where that thought process comes from. And it's just, this is like one of the worst things that I think anyone has done that we've covered on this podcast. But like I said, nonetheless, it is a law. So that is where Clark Elmore will stay until his death, in Walla Walla State Prison.
You know, when you think about it, you know, it is a life sentence, you know, because he is going to die in there. And it is a slow torture, which is very well deserved. You know, and if we look even what the mother said, Sue, like she said, you know, him dying via the death penalty would be an easy thing.
It would be too good.
Right. It would be too good for him to get that. So I think that at least we're getting what the mother wants. And I'm very sorry for the mother. And I'm sorry for our victim here. It's so sad, you know, that this had to happen to her. But the writing was on the walls.
It was. I mean, I feel like he gave her both, right? That's what he gave Chrissy Onstad. He gave her a life sentence and the death penalty.
Yeah.
And that's why I think people get so enraged about this case. And I think, yes, to a larger degree, this case speaks about the system failing her in a way, because there are a lot of red flags with her behavior, the way that the family moved around. But that is kind of, unfortunately, what some families do in which there's abuse happening. Not saying that Sue Onstad was privy to it, but there's a reason why he wanted to keep moving them around and around. And it's a tactic that's used, and that is a tactic that's used to block the system from working, for teachers and school officials to recognize that abuse is taking place.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we're going to have victims like this throughout the course of our lives that, you know, unfortunately, that will happen. The hope is that you are able to learn from this, as sad and as unfortunate as it is. We grow as a society and find a better way, hopefully, to handle this in the future so that way it stops happening. I mean, that is the goal here at the end of the day. It's just sad that so many people have to lose their lives before we can get to a place where it's not happening as frequently, or it's not happening at all. You know what I mean?
Especially that's the tough part. Especially children.
Yes. And that is the really tough part. I think we've made some strides, but I think it needs a lot of work still.
Yes, definitely. I think mandatory reporting laws are something that helps tremendously. And I think that saved a lot of lives. But it is true. We just have to always be, you know, looking for signs and looking a little deeper into maybe why someone's acting the way they are.
Yeah, we need to be vigilant. And I think that is a community thing. I don't think it's just within your four walls, so to speak, of your home.
Right.
I think that's a community thing. So
I agree. Okay. Well, that concludes this case. And what we're going to do next time is we're going to list all of our Patreon supporters. We're going to have that list for you. So if you've joined since the last episode, be sure to listen for your name in the next episode coming up. Okay, guys. And in this case, we really mean it. Until next time, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.